It's also an impertinence to be introducing Doris Lessing because you know all about her. And I'm sure there are many people in this room whose lives her work has been a formative experience, in some cases a transformative experience. She's lived in the UK for more than half a century, but of course she was brought up in Zimbabwe, as it's called now, then southern Rhodesia, having been born in Iran. But after she came to Britain after the Second World War, her novels, The Grass is Singing, for example, and The Golden Notebook, immediately established her as a dominant voice in British culture and indeed in world culture. She's influenced our understanding of colonization. She's influenced our understanding of relations between the sexes. She's made us see that there's a strong connection between the two. Above all, she's taken us into her imaginative world, as well as her, if there's a difference, and I know she doesn't believe there is, her real world, through her art of storytelling. And storytelling is one of the things she writes about very well in this collection of miscellaneous introductions and essays and reviews, Time Bites, which is her latest book. Doris Lessing has, of course, won most of the prizes that most writers would like to win, such as the David Cohen British Literature Prize and the Prince of Asturias Prize. These are prizes which are the highest marks of esteem that fellow writers can award on those they most admire. Her most recent fictional work was The Grandmother, which is four novellas, published a couple of years ago. She has another fictional work coming out next year. But meanwhile, what she'll be reading from this evening is, as I say, Time Bites, an extraordinarily diverse collection in which her attention ranges from Jane Austen to The Fables of Bidpai, from writing autobiography to cats, from Zimbabwe to Sufism to the music of Philip Glass. There's also a piece in here about the Royal Free Hospital in North London, where her mother worked as a nurse. And that piece was first published as a result of an initiative here in the Warwick Writing Programme. David Morley edited an anthology of pieces specially commissioned about the National Health Service, and called The Gift. And that essay about the Royal Free, or that autobiographical rumination, appeared there. Now, she's going to be reading to us. I know she's afraid your attention will wander if she reads for too long, but I've assured her she can read all night and our attention won't wander. Then she and I are going to have a bit of a conversation while you're thinking about the questions you want to ask, which I'm sure will be many. And I'll try to shut myself up soon enough to enable you to get your questions in. And after that, those of you who don't already have copies of her work can, if you wish, buy them outside this room and bring them back in, and I know that Doris Lessing will be willing to sign them then. So please join me in welcoming Doris Lessing.
I'm going to read three bits. The first one, it's from a piece I wrote about Zimbabwe for the New York Review of Books, and it was published there last year. And quoted in the House of Commons, not that that changed anything, I say this because writers often have the illusion that they're going to change things. So this piece was written with passion, but has changed nothing. I'm going to read the beginning of it. It's called The Tragedy of Zimbabwe. "You have the jewel of Africa in your hands," said President Samora Machel of Mozambique and President Julius Nyerere of Tanzania to Robert Mugabe at the moment of independence in 1980. "Now look after it." 23 years later, and the jewel is ruined, dishonored, disgraced. Southern Rhodesia, whose it only lasted for 90 years, people tend to forget, Southern Rhodesia had fine and functioning railways, good roads, its towns were policed and clean. It could grow anything, tropical fruit like pineapples, mangoes, bananas, plantains, pawpaws, passion fruit, temperate fruits like apples, peaches, plums. The staple food, maize, grew like a weed and fed surrounding countries as well. Peanuts, sunflowers, cotton, the millets and small grains that used to be staple foods before maize flourished. Minerals, gold, chromium, asbestos, platinum, and rich coal fields. The dammed Zambezi created the Kariba Lake, which fed electricity north and south. A paradise, not only for the whites, the blacks did well too, at least physically. Not politically, it was a police state and a harsh one. When the blacks rebelled and won their war, they looked forward to plenty and competence that existed nowhere else in Africa, not even in South Africa, which was bedeviled by its many mutually hostile tribes and its vast shanty towns. But paradise has to have a superstructure, an infrastructure, and by now it is going, almost gone. One man is associated with a calamity, Robert Mugabe. For a while I wondered if the word tragedy could be applied here. Greatness brought low, but Mugabe, despite his early reputation, was never that, was always a frightened little man. There is a tragedy, all right, but it is Zimbabwe's. Mugabe is now extricated, and rightly, but blame for him began late. Nothing is more astonishing than the silence for so many years of the liberals, the well-wishers, the politically correct. What crimes have been committed in its name? Political correctness. A man may get away with murder if he is black, and he did for many years. Early in his regime, we might have seen what he was when the infamous 5th Brigade, thugs from North Korea, hated by blacks and whites alike, became Mugabe's bodyguard and did his dirty work, notably when he attempted what was virtually genocide in Matabeleland. Hindsight gives us a clear picture of his depredations at the time. Mendacity ruled, always confusion. But the fact was, we knew the 5th Brigade. It had already murdered and raped. It was confusion, too, because Mugabe seemed to begin well. He was a Marxist, true, but like other politicians before and since, he said the right things. For instance, that blacks and whites must flourish together. And he passed a law against corruption, forbidding the top echelon of officials from owning more than one property. When his officials only laughed and bought farm after farm, hotels, businesses, anything that they could grab, he did nothing. It was at this point when everyone should have said, "This is no strong man, he's a weakling." From the start, Mugabe has been afraid to show his face out of doors without outriders, guards, motorcades, all the defenses of paranoia. When the Queen visited and refused to be in an armored car, insisted on an open one, people jeered as the frightened man clung to the sides of the car, while the insouciant sovereign smiled and waved. Here is the heart of the tragedy. Never has a ruler come to power with more goodwill. Everybody, the people who voted for him and the ones who did not, forgot their differences and expected from him the fulfillment of their dreams and of his promises. He could have done anything in those early years. When you traveled around the villages in the early 80s, you heard from everyone, "Mugabe will do this, Comrade Mugabe will do that. We'll see the value of this or that plan, build this shop or clinic or road, help us with our school, check that bullying official." If Mugabe had had the sense to trust them, he could have transformed the country. But he didn't know how much he was trusted because he was too afraid to leave his self-created prison, meeting only sycophants and cronies, and governing through inflexible Marxist rules got out of textbooks. This goes on for quite a... There's simply no time for reading all that. Now, a friend of mine was present not so long ago when Mugabe had a party gathering in just that area where the 5th Brigade had done most of their dirty work, you know, murdering, filling the wells full of corpses and so on and so on. He chose that place to have a ZANU-PF rally. It was very well attended because people were not eating, you know, the food supply had collapsed. And he was dishing out food, so there were plenty of people there for the food. And this was described to me, that he got out of one of his many cars. He never travels with less than dozens. He got out of his car and, I quote, skipping like a lamb, and he's about my age, he frolicked through the crowd throwing carnations left and right. Now, it is now a cliche to say no writer can come up with anything as good as what life does. And I don't think any one of us would have been able to imagine that scene. It is too horrible and shameful. Now, that was that piece. I want to read a little bit about The Golden Notebook. That's probably for older people in the audience, I expect, because the young one might not know. Anyway, this was a reissue of The Golden Notebook, and this particular preface was for America. This novel's progress continues to surprise me because it keeps putting its head up in new places and often not where one would expect. The most recent was China, where I was on a trip at the invitation of the Chinese writers. Now, I have to interrupt myself and say there that I later learned that this vast edition, you know, for us, but not for them, 80,000, was not at all what was described to me. In actual fact, they had taken the Golden Notebook and taken out all the sexy bits and published the sexy bits as a kind of pornographic book, which I wasn't told about, you see, because they weren't... which is not really the... But later they've published it properly. Anyway, the edition sold out in 3 days, not surprisingly. It had been published once before and had done well. Everyone has read it, they say, meaning, as this usually does these days, mostly people in universities. That is because in poor countries of the world, people can't afford to buy books. But the people in universities have read them. The universities I visited in Beijing, Shanghai, Xi'an, and Canton, or Guangzhou, have a most lively and informed interest in British and American literature. Only now has it occurred to me that universities are more and more are equivalent to the medieval monasteries, keeping things of the mind alive and well in poor countries where people cannot afford to buy books. Not that China can any longer be described as a poor country. Recently, I got a letter from a waitress in a hotel in Rio saying, I can't afford to buy books. My husband works in the university and he's allowed to use the library, and he got the Golden Notebook for me, and I feel I must tell you, and so on. I hear the book is being set in history classes and politics classes in schools and universities. This pleases me, since one of the reasons I wrote the novel was that I felt there are blank spaces where novels ought to be, particularly in the 19th century literature. I still would like to read novels that gave the flavor and taste of, let's say, the Chartists and their personal lives, their discussions, their conflicts, or perhaps the small revolutionary groups that flourished in London, most of them fermenting revolution in Europe. I think The Golden Notebook is a useful testament to its time, particularly now that communism is dead or dying everywhere or changing its nature. Nothing seems more improbable than what people believed when this belief has gone with the wind. Novels give you the matrix of emotions, give you the flavor of a time in a way former history cannot. A Yugoslav woman student said to me, and now this dates reminiscence, how interesting to read about all that, those old politics. Old and exotic in communist Yugoslavia, but you may hear too, it described what happened in my political group in the 70s, or The Golden Notebook describes my life as a woman. When it first came out, it was considered quite an advanced book. Recently, it was given to girls of 15 in a school in North London, and they took it in their stride. I was walking along a street in northwest London, and up bounced a chubby girl of about 15 and said, "Hi, Doris, I've just read The Golden Notebook. Wow." Now, and I thought, this is supposed to be a difficult book. You see, it is no longer. This year, now we're back before the collapse of Zimbabwe. This year, it is being read in a class in the University of Zimbabwe at the request of black and white students, male and female. They were surprised, so said the teacher, a friend, that the talk of the young communists was idealistic and optimistic in those ancient days before there was a communist regime in Zimbabwe. They associated communism and communists with self-seeking and opportunism. It had never occurred to them that communism had begun as a genuine dream for a better world. I continue to get letters from men about The Golden Notebook, as many as from women. I've always had as many letters from men. Interestingly, they, right from the start, they will write about the politics or the madness themes and not apparently notice that there are themes about women. They may say it opened their eyes to the feelings and experiences of women, or that what interests them is the politics or the style of the main American character who now seems to them quite ridiculously macho. Or a woman writes to say, and this has happened often, that her boyfriend or husband gave her the book, saying it influenced him. I also hear the other side of this when a man says he's just read one of my books and liked it. He was at a university where Doris Lessing was a property of the women's movement, and so he didn't bother to read my books, and now he was sorry he didn't, and he was writing to tell me so. Yes, I do get a lot of feedback, and I'm always interested, particularly when it is unexpected. In Vermont, there is a bookstore called The Golden Notebook, and if it's still there, I have a permanent invitation to go and have a cup of coffee. I reread the novel the other day and remembered the fury of energy that went into it. Probably that is why the book goes on as it does, because of its charge. It does have a remarkable vitality. Some of it is the energy of conflict. I was writing my way out of one set of ideas, even out of a way of life, but that is not what I thought while I was doing it. Inside that tight framework is an effervescence. Sometimes the energy of a book contradicts its apparent message. The first time I thought about this was when I read Dostoevsky's The Devils and found myself invigorated and optimistic, when in fact a more pessimistic story could hardly be imagined. The other of my books written with the same intensity could not, on the face of it, be more different than The Golden Notebook. It is the making of the representative of Planet 8. That's the one that became an opera with Philip Glass. Both books mark limits. I meet women in their 50s who say, "I was influenced by this book and I gave it to my daughter and she loves it." Or a young woman says, "My mother gave me this book because she said it was important to her and now I understand her much better." I used to hear, "My mother read it, now I do." So that's two generations. But the other day, I was told of a grandmother who gave it to her son, who gave it to his daughter. Three generations, and yes, I am indeed flattered. Currently, I am writing volume one of my autobiography, this is written way back, and thinking about some of the people and events that went into The Golden Notebook, I have to conclude that fiction is better than the truth. I'm sorry, fiction is better at the truth than a factual record. Why this should be so is a very large subject, and one I don't begin to understand, and one I have thought a lot about. Why it should be that one can sit, revive a scene in your mind as it was, write it, concerned to get every syllable right, but it doesn't have the life in it that the same scene that you've, it's not the truth, but you've fiddled about with. Why is one fizzing with life and the other one is not? Don't ask me, I don't know. It is very odd, though. It is very strange. And I continue to think about it. There are scenes in The Golden Notebook that have this mysterious quality, life. There's absolutely no doubt about it. But I don't know why. I think most writers would say they don't know why something is or not. A lot of mysterious things happen when you write. I've recently written a book which is a sequel to Mara and Dan, simply for the pleasure of it, because I enjoyed writing that book so much. And for the first time in my writing career, a character emerged that I hadn't planned for, because normally I have a rough idea where I'm going. Out pops this character and dominates the entire book from then on. Now, it's quite creepy when this happens. A character cannot come out of the air. A character has to be part of you somewhere. I mean, it has to. It can't come out of nowhere. Supposing you don't recognize this person, and yet he dominates the book. Who is he? Where is he? Is he going to come out in some situation in life? Now, there's a certain character that emerges in my books, and one sex or the other, one age or another. This person is, they don't function. They're, one way or another, they're a washout. Male, female, old, young, this person is not functioning. Where is this person? It's in me. Now, this is quite frightening. Under what circumstances is this non-functioning, hopeless person going to emerge? You know, it's a thought, isn't it? I mean, you have to think it. When this thing emerges again and again and again, he's one of my personalities, she or he. The writing is not without its hazards, right? Okay, now I'm going to read a little bit I wrote, a little piece, for an anthology about being old. I just wrote it because I was asked to. And here we are. So me, it's called Old. The approach to old age that Via Dolorosa is presented to us as a long descent after the golden age of youth. Yet it would be hard to find someone who wouldn't shudder at the idea of living through their teens again, or even their 20s. You have to grow slowly into a competence with your emotions, and I've heard plenty say their 30s or 40s were the best time. Not so clean-cut living, classified by Shakespeare as one stage after another, particularly when the first signs of physical old age start pretty young, with your first white hairs, snow and summer. Yet, that at some point along the way certain events will take place, we know, we have been warned, they never stop going on about it. Teeth, eyes, ears, skin. You'd think that there could be no surprises. But I don't remember anyone saying you're going to shrink. My skirts, comfortable at calf or ankle length one day, are sweeping the ground the next. What has happened? Have they stretched? No, I'm 4 inches shorter, I'm now 5 inches shorter, and from thinking of myself as a well-set-up woman, I begin to wonder what height qualifies me to be called a dwarf. It is not a surprise to look in the mirrors and think, who's that old woman? Not unexpected to see yourself in old family photographs as your mother or your grandfather. To find the years start skipping by, that acceleration began early. But now start the delightful surprises. Time becomes fluid. It is entertaining to look at an old face, on a bus perhaps, and imagine how it must have been when it was young, or to smudge a young face into what it will be in 30 years or 40. A little girl, dancing about, you see her as a young woman, middle-aged, old. Computers have taught us to do it. And inside this fluidity, a permanence. For the person who looks at the old face in the mirror is the same as the one who shares your earliest memories, when you were 2, perhaps, or less. That child's core is the same as the old woman's. Here I still am. I haven't changed at all. Best of all, not ever predicted, nor, I think, described, a fresh liveliness in experiencing. It is as if some gauze or screen has been dissolved away from life that was dulling it. And like Miranda, you want to say, what a brave new world. You don't remember feeling like this because younger, habit, or the press of necessity prevented it. You are taken, shaken by moments when the improbability of our lives comes over you like a fever. Everything is remarkable. People, living, events present themselves to you with the immediacy of players in some barbarous and splendid drama that it seems we are part of. You have been given new eyes. This must be what a very small child feels, looking out at the world for the first time, everything a wonder. Old age is a great reviver of memories in more ways than one. Now, in this book, there is a piece called Writing Autobiography, which actually was a full lecture, which I've cut down slightly, and it was written to be read. If anybody is interested in it, if you could remember that if you're reading it, if you're talking it, it's a very different animal from when you're reading it. Because I wrote it listening, when I wrote it to talk, I was listening to it in my mind's ear, which of course is not there in print. So this is another hazard of writing. You write a lecture and it turns up in print and then becomes something written in stone and unalterable, which is nice for academics but bad for writers, because then they write to you and say, you said in 1962, I did. Did I mean it? Did I believe? What was the context? I have no idea. Okay, so.
Thank you very much indeed. I was very struck by your talking about thinking about writing autobiography. The feeling that somehow it didn't come out, not only not as fresh, but not as true somehow as the fiction. And there's another passage in the book where you describe being in a bookshop, and there are a couple of schoolgirls there who don't know their way around a bookshop. They've been sent there by a teacher but don't know what to do there. And you show them how it works and how it's divided up, and you show them there's a novel section, and then you say there's a biography section. Biography is stories about other people, you say. And then you say there's an autobiography section. Autobiography is stories about yourself. So that there's that implication, it seems, that it's all somehow... That there's no hard and fast boundary between truth and fiction. And I just wondered whether, in the case of writing autobiography after you've written fiction, as it were, returning to those earlier scenes that you've made imaginative life out of, the problem that you're perceiving, I think not your readers, is to do with the fact that you've already done it once. Whereas if you were a memoirist first, it would come out differently. So the first question is a practical one. Is it just to do with the fact that it's revisiting the same material in a different way the second time? And the second question is really the one you raised just now about imaginative versus real truth. And I agree that that's very difficult, but you intimated that you were thinking about it a lot, and perhaps you'd like to say a bit more about it.
When I sat down to write Vol 1 of my autobiography, it may seem improbable, but I'd never once thought about it, because I'd never really done it. I hadn't thought about the difference between novels and autobiography. I simply took it for granted that there was a great difference. Now, in actual fact, the more you think about it, the more it blurs, because there's no way you can write everything you remember. Otherwise, you get going to 20 volumes. No one would be awake at the end of the first volume. So you have to then say, you find a kind of a shape creeping in, as there would be for a novel. There's another problem. You know, whole batches of people disappear. Friendships, you simply cannot write it all. You can't. So then you start getting very uneasy. is this the truth? How can it be the truth when I'm leaving out so much? But it's not only that. Is what I'm remembering the truth? Which is, because as we all know, our memories are extremely unreliable, particularly the early ones, which our parents put into us, mostly. You know, every parent says to a child, you know, do you remember how we used to go to the park and I made chicken sandwiches and you used to play with the dog? And the child dutifully remembers all this. But it's not the child's memories, it's the parent's memories. And you have to then, if you're writing an autobiography, try and work out what is your memory, not your parent's memory. So there's that problem. Just the problem of what you believe is the truth, but then it's a question of putting it on the page is a whole different thing. And I didn't really to start to think about this until there's a certain section in the Golden Notebook, which, when I wrote it in autobiography, I thought, hang on, this is true. What I'm writing down is the truth. Yet it lacks that quality, which, when I wrote it in a novel, which had a different, you know, it didn't matter whether it was true or not, because there's some characters that didn't exist and so on, but it was truer. Now, people must have thought about this before. I'm looking at you inquiringly. What have they said about it?
Well, I've been writing about V.S. Pritchett. Well, I have just written about V.S. Pritchett. The book's coming out, so I hope I'm not writing about him anymore. Who himself did many trial runs for writing about his early life, including about his father, in short stories, in a novel, Mr. Bellancourt. And then later in his autobiographical books, A Cab at the Door and Midnight Oil. Mm. And I think his account was very similar to yours, that he said at one point that it was like going out in a boat into the middle of the sea. You were talking about this I, and then you suddenly thought, who is this I that I'm writing about? I don't know who he is, and I'm out here in the middle of the sea, and I'm lost.
Well, I don't know.
Sorry.
Go on.
Something you say, writing about, this is to sort of bring this around to a different question, but a related one, in that essay about autobiography, is that ultimately you think the most important thing is the tone or voice in whatever you're writing.
Oh, yes, I remember I said something which I think is true. well, I hope it is. That if you're writing an autobiography, the person who's writing it is the same from start to finish. There is this tone.
That
is the tone of this book. And it sort of evens everything out. But in actual fact, we're not one person, any of us. We're different people. And I'm not talking about roles. I mean, I'm not talking about the role, you know, father, husband, I don't know, teacher, grandfather, the social roles. I'm talking about the different personalities in people, which is much easier to see in a novel. And in some writers, it's extremely easy to see, like, for example, Dickens. The same people pop up in Dickens. I mean, different sexes, different ages and all that, but they're obviously the same characters. This is Dickens. Whereas, did Dickens write an autobiography? No, he didn't. Well, it would probably have been written in this tone, which irons everything out. There's something about autobiography which is very suspicious, you know. It's and I'm very certain, you see, another thing, that I used to think an autobiography was what a person thought about his or her life. What I now think, it's what this person thought at the time of writing. So I would like to know, for example, how would Rousseau's thoughts about his life seemed 20 years later if he'd ever done it. It wouldn't have been the same at all. Any more than if I had written my autobiography age 50, it would have been a very different document, believe me, to the one I actually wrote. And if I'm spared, as they say, and I write a scene here, it's going to be different, simply because your life looks different to you all the time. It changes all the time. So it's all very fluid. And in another, I've forgotten which essay, one of the problems is that print makes things, it grays things in stone, but life isn't like that at all. It's
that corresponds to an experience I've had interviewing people who have written memoirs. If I'm writing a book and they knew the person I'm writing about, and I go and talk to them about that person, they tell me what they've written in their book. And it's very hard to go beyond that. It's as if not only is it graven in stone once they write it, but everything else has somehow been not only left out of the book, but driven out of memory.
This is true. If you write, for example, to go back to the Golden Notebook, that scene in the Golden Notebook, there are two realities. The novel, the scene in the novel, and the scene as I remember it. But the scene as I remember it had to be brought back because it had already dissolved into fiction, whatever fiction is.
I want to, there are so many people here, and I'm sure that many of them are longing to ask questions, so I want to open it up now. I have other things I want to ask you, but I don't want to hog this. I may not hear your question very well because I'm a bit deaf and the acoustic in this room is not very good, but I need to hear it because then I'm going to repeat it for the sake of a recording and so that everybody else in the room can hear it. So it'll take a little while. Yes, please.
Have you, looking at from your life, are there any thoughts of wisdom or just things that, I mean, that you know now that you wish you'd known when you say you're 20?
The question is, as Doris looks back over her life, is there anything, any wisdom she would like to impart to a younger generation, things that she wishes she'd known when she was in her 20s?
Well, one, the most important one is that I've actually put in here, it's somebody, an old person said to me when I was very young, this person said, when you, don't forget, you know, it was the late 30s and the 40s, what you have to remember is it's what individuals do that is important, not the great powers. Now, what I was seeing when I looked out at the world was Hitler's Germany, which was going to last for 1,000 years, Mussolini's Italy, which was going to last for 1,000 years, the Soviet Union, which was going to last forever, by definition, the British Empire, which showed no signs at that time of departing, all the European powers and empires except Germany, who had lost hers, the racist structure, all these things seemed permanent. And they've all gone as if they never were. If anyone had said to me, age 17, 18, 20, that all this is going to disappear as if it never was, I would have thought they were mad. So now when I look out and see certain fairly terrifying great powers, I think, hang on, how long are you going to last? And I offer this thought to you when you might be overpowered by these great structures which are much less powerful than you think they are. They are not monolithic and strong and all of one substance. They are riven, broken up in conflict. And can disappear overnight, believe me.
I wish you could chair one of these presidential debates.
Well, I mean, what a joke. What a joke they are.
Please. This is a very interesting question. For those who didn't hear it, it's about some reflections of Doris's on Marxism and on the appeal to her when she was young of one particular aspect of Marxism, which was that it saw the whole world as a whole, that something that happened in Siberia might affect something that happened in Botswana. And the questioner asks whether Doris still thinks that, and more broadly, if I've got this right, whether she thinks Marxism has anything to offer today.
Well, yes, you see, when I look back on this with considerable nostalgia, all of us lot, us young Reds, we took it absolutely for granted that a sugar mill going in Cuba was of great importance to us, and it was our personal responsibility, or something in Tristan da Cunha was something that we should be bothered about. This, of course, was hubris on a fairly high level, but we did feel like that. And there was a world view of totally illusory, I have to say, but this is how we felt. And while it lasted, it was pretty heady stuff, you know, thinking that we were so important. Now it's gone to the point where I look back on... it was just amazing. You see, when you hear young people talking now, it's about the latest shopping mall or something. Whereas we were always discussing what went on in Siberia. Now, I'm not saying this was any showed any great virtue, but it certainly was more interesting, believe me. Now, I don't think Marxism has got much to offer now. No, I don't think so.
It sounds as though you're saying you don't think it had much to offer then, as if it was a... You said it was hubris, as if it was gratifying to people like you to have these vicarious feelings or these excitable feelings about other places. But actually, are you saying that you don't think that Marxism did any good at the time?
No, I think it was a total folly, and I think we were all crazy. And the reason why I think we were crazy, I think, was because of the wars that we assume end when the armistice... And this is a very big subject, obviously, I can't go into it. But no, I think we were all crazy. Can you imagine batches of fairly arbitrarily associated young people genuinely believing that the future of the world depended on them? We really believed it. You know, a communist is a dead man on leave, quote unquote. Some of us had it over our beds. I'm glad to say I didn't, but it's a slight sign of grace, I suppose. But some of us did. A communist is a dead man on leave, and similar exalted notions. Now, this was madness, you know, any way you care to look at it.
But if you lose the idea that the individual can make a difference, then the next step is to say it doesn't matter whether you vote or not.
Isn't it?
And that despair has entered into our society. More people don't vote than do in most elections. And isn't that a bad thing?
Yeah, well, voting or not voting, that's a different thing. Of course we should vote. I come of the generation not to vote. I think of all the people who died to get us a vote. I couldn't not vote. But this is not... When I talk about the individual efforts, you don't have to put that necessarily into immediately political terms, do you? You don't immediately have to think about going onto the barricades, which is the way we thought. I think that what the people do individually is desperately important.
Everyone. There's a question in the back row there.
Have you heard your book spread as in, you know, on tape and sort of run? I'm talking about because I am. How do you feel about the interpretation of your words by that voice that you might not have chosen to be in your work? And how does it change for you?
The questioner who said, tells us that she's blind asks how Doris responds to hearing her work read in recordings and to the interpretative changes that may or may not have come in the process.
Well, I don't know what the changes are because they're nothing to do with me. So they just change things. No, I never have heard anything at all. But I recently listened to the start of War and Peace recorded, and when I saw what they'd left out, I was very angry, and I'm glad I hadn't heard any of the others, because it was so irresponsible what they'd left out. But I'm sorry if you...
Disagree with having
there's a question whether you think you shouldn't be abridged. In that case, your own work, when it's recorded, should not be abridged.
I don't know. I think I'd rather it was not abridged, of course. But it's better that it's abridged than not at all, I think. I should imagine that people who are blind would rather have War and Peace, even if it's been mutilated, than not have it at all. I don't know.
Can I let another questioner in, please? I'm going to have difficulty summarising that, but it's a complex question. It's about, I don't know how much of it you heard.
I didn't hear any.
It's about the secret dream and about ideology, whether it's better for a writer to have an ideology or to avoid having an ideology and to take a critical stance. Am I getting this roughly right? Get the microphone. You were also introducing a question about religion there, I thought.
The
theological commitment. And if I could sort of put my own spin on the question and tell me if this is going to really take it too far away from what you're getting at. You have obviously in your life made a move from a political kind of commitment to a religious one, to Sufism. And I wonder whether you could talk about the effect of that in your work. Is that too far away from...
Well, it began with abstract question. Is it better to have a program or not? It's not something you choose, it seems to me. You write out of what you are thinking at any given time or feeling. You don't start off saying, now I'm going to write out of a philosophy, now I'm going to write out of a belief. This is what you are when you write. Is that okay? About the Sufism is not a religion. Religion. It's not a religion. It's not a commitment to ideas, which I can only say that the people who've actually been involved with it will know what I mean. So it's not a faith. So not at all a question of writing out of a belief or anything like that. I personally think probably my most Sufic book is one that I wrote long before I ever heard of any kind of mysticism. It's the Golden Notebook. But I haven't ever written any book later that was written out of this philosophy, you want to call it that. So there's a book I wrote called Shikasta, which is the first of the Canopus and Argus series, which I wrote, which was taken as a cosmology because it started a religion off in America, I regret to say. An ideal community came into being based on it, and they wrote to me asking me to become its guru, and I wrote back and said, I'm terribly sorry, this is a novel and not a religion. And I got a very, very cross letter back saying that I didn't know I was reneging on my responsibility. But I'm glad to say that this particular religion has dissolved. So I no longer feel guilty about this.
I made such a hash of the last question that I was afraid nobody would ask another one, but I have a question here. Who are the people you go back to who've influenced your work and who are models to you?
Well, I have great difficulty because any writer who's got any kind of reputation is deluged with books and publishers. I've had 14 this week, right? And I am but human. So I'm always desperately trying to catch up on the books, because every writer knows that you can make the difference to a young writer by saying, I think this is a good book or not. So you're perpetually guilty if you don't have a look at these. This means you don't have time to read the books you want to read, which I would like to go back to read all the Russians all over again. But when? I reread all of Stendhal last year, which was wonderful. It was one of my favorites. That's my situation. Sorry.
There's a question here and then one here. Is the question, do readers need to distinguish between fiction and autobiography? Thank you.
Yes, I do think so. If you're reading a novel, you are saying, this is what this writer is, how this writer is generalizing out of personal experience, which is why the question, is this book autobiographical? It's very irritating to every writer, because you always try to generalize out of personal experience. When you're writing an autobiography, you are saying to yourself, this is what I think should be said. This is what this writer thinks about his or her life at this time. And not, this is what this writer thinks for all time about his or her life.
I was very struck by something you said early on when you were reading out the Zimbabwe piece of writing, where you said you don't think it made any difference. Do you think writers generally sort of can affect the material world, or are they entirely sort of relegated to the role of commentators, or as you know, just light entertainment? Do you think it actually has a definite effect on the world?
So it's the old and always important question, can a writer actually affect things? It's in response to Doris's pessimism about whether her piece about Zimbabwe made any difference. And the questioner asks, can a writer make any difference, or is the writer relegated to the role of a commentator or light entertainer?
I think it's a question of timing, whether you have any effect or not. I know that the books written round about the time of The Grass is Singing had an effect, because in this country, people were totally ignorant about what went on in South Africa, and they saw that there's a land full of happy darkies singing and dancing day and night. And the writers, like myself, and particularly Alan Paton, made a difference. Because apartheid hadn't come into existence then, it was later, the apartheid writers made a big difference. People like Solzhenitsyn in Russia made a big difference. One of the major factors in bringing down the Soviet Empire. But sometimes, now I remember standing at the door, aged 19, in then Salisbury, because I never stepped in those days, as far as I can make out, watching that day's crop of prisoners being marched down the road. The South Africans here will know what it means to be out without a pass. These were the blacks caught being out without a pass that night, with handcuffs, chains, walking down the street with a policeman four on front. And I was thinking, this scene was described in Dostoevsky, in Tolstoy. It's been described 1,000 times, and here they still are. It was a very depressing thought for someone who had ambitions to change things.
Question at the back there. I'm sorry, I can't hear you. to write about age differences, to write either about their old age or about their youth in particular? Is there something about writing about your youth that enables you to recapture it?
I wrote this piece about being old because I asked to write it. I was asked to write it, so I wrote it for a anthology.
No,
why should I? I'm a professional.
All right.
Of course not. Don't say that. About writing about being young, it doesn't revive it any more than memories do. You know, any time I can say I put myself back into this or that age with great ease. There's nothing, you don't have to write in order to do that. It's, I'm sure that's true of anyone with even mildly white hair here. Can't you put yourself back into yourself 30, 20? In fact, I think I'm much, much more often 20 than I am 85, for God's sake.
I did think one of the things that was so striking and encouraging and moving about that piece was your sense that there are whole crucial respects in which you remain exactly the same person, and you don't see yourself as having, don't feel yourself as having changed at all.
When did you realize you are a writer? Was there a moment when you realized that you are a writer, wanted to be a writer?
When did Doris Lessing realize that she was a writer and that that's what she wanted to be?
Well, I was writing when I was very, very young, and my first published piece was when I was 7. My mother sent a rather high-powered piece about a sunset to the Rhodesia Herald, not one of the great publications of the world. But now this is where memory comes in, you see. I would have said with absolute confidence that I was not saying I was going to be a writer till I was much older. But then I met a woman who had been a schoolgirl with me and at the convent, so had to be not older than 11, and she said, I was sitting on my bed in the dorm, and we were talking about what we were going to do, and I said I was going to be a writer. I have no recollection of this. So.
I think we've time for a couple more questions. There's one back there. Yes.
I was wondering about this issue about the resonance and the difficulty or the vibrance that comes with writing fiction versus autobiography. And I guess one of the things that strikes me is that
this is a statement, not a question.
Do you agree that it's easier or that you get more resonance out of writing about further away experiences than more recent ones in autobiography? Is childhood somehow more possible to evoke?
No, you see, you haven't defined resonance at all, have you? Or what is this word? What is this quality? Because I don't know what it is. I have no idea.
But you did yourself say that in looking at your autobiographical accounts of experiences which you had treated fictionally, you felt there was something lacking, whether resonance is the right word or not. There was something missing, something flat.
I didn't say it was missing. It was just different.
All right.
One is an account, as factual as I can make it.
Yeah.
But then I read the scene that came out of this germ, and I think, right, that's the truth.
Yeah.
Don't ask me now, what is the truth?
No, I won't do that. Please, last question. This is a question which is sort of very apropos given what Doris Lessing has said about feeling that the work doesn't make any difference.
The question is, what is the motivation for writing politically? Is it a catharsis, or do you want to get something across to people even though you fear? Yes, even though you fear that it doesn't make any difference.
Politically? This is a new idea suddenly. I have never written a book with a political message. I have written about politics, but that's very different from writing. Did you mean to use the word politically? I think not.
Were you trying to get across, have you tried to get across a particular attitude? Is there a motive behind it, or is it something else that puts the politics in?
Well, you see, I don't think I have ever written a book with a clear-cut message, though other people seem to think I have. I don't think I have. When I sit down to write, I'm not trying to make people think anything. Something at that particular time has sparked me off. I care about whatever it is at that particular time, and I need to write it. But I'm not thinking about who's going to read it, because if you start doing that, you start changing your writing to fit this imaginary reader. It becomes a censor. And it's extremely easy to set up censors for yourself. You have to watch that you're not doing it. And the imaginary reader, believe me, is a powerful censor. So you don't want that woman or man in it.
Thank you very much. Well, in that essay, Ode, that she read to us near the end, Doris Lessing talked about one of the pleasures of her current time being a fresh liveliness in experiencing. And I think we've all experienced a fresh liveliness in Doris Lessing's experiencing tonight. Thank you very much, Doris.
Thank you.